Welcome to The Investing Show, where we discuss ideas to help you make more of your money. I'm Simon Lambert of This Is Money, and joining me in the studio today, we have Tom Slater of Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust and Richard Hunter of Interactive Investor.
Simon.
Now, to many investors, the £7.5 billion Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust won't need much of an introduction. It invests around the world in some of the companies that have become household names. But Tom, beyond that, can you tell us a little bit more about what Scottish Mortgage does, where it invests, and what the philosophy is behind that?
Yeah, absolutely. So the philosophy of the trust is that we're trying to achieve long-term capital appreciation for our shareholders. And we do that by investing in what we believe are the world's most exciting, interesting growth companies that we think have the most attractive long-term prospects. And where we find those companies, we aim to be very long-term and patient shareholders. And so what that means in practice is that the trust will be volatile over short periods of time, but we think that's necessary if we're going to achieve that long-term capital appreciation for our shareholders.
And these are the companies that you think are going to be making the future. They'll be the ones that are there making their mark in 5, 10, 15, 20 years' time and changing the world along the way, are they?
Yeah, well, we think that we're in a period of huge change, that technology-enabled business models are transforming the way many parts of the economy operate. And as a result of that, you get big winners and you get big losers. So trying to identify the companies that, as you say, drive that change, you know, the individuals, the entrepreneurs who are really building out that future, and where we find them, backing them for the long term. So not over the next quarter or the next half year, but over periods of 5 or 10 years to deliver on that vision. And the other important facet of what we do is that in that low turnover, long term approach is we keep our costs to an absolute minimum. We share the benefits of the scale of the trust. You mentioned it, the size at the start. And we use that to drive down the annual charge to our shareholders, but also at the same time increase the value by investing in private companies if we can identify companies that we think drive those changes that aren't listed on the public stock markets. So increasing at the same time as driving down the cost, increasing the value of what we offer to shareholders.
Given the pace of change in technology at the moment, how difficult is it to start looking out even 5 years, let alone over a longer period of time?
Yeah, I think the important part in the answer to that question is that we don't think that we can predict the future, that we don't have the answer of what the world looks like in 5 or 10 years' time. But more to Simon's question, can we find the entrepreneurs and the companies that we think are shaping that future?
Yeah.
And then backing their creativity and their vision in realising that. But actually, if you look at some of these franchises, we think they will have very long duration opportunities. If you take something like Amazon, you know, its period of dominance in online retail spans more than a decade now. You know, if you look at Alphabet in search or Tencent in the Chinese social sphere, we don't think there's any reason why if the business model is underpinned by technology, it should mean its longevity is any less than, you know, more traditional companies.
Yeah.
And do you think that people tend to think like that a bit with companies that are driven by technology, where we think of Amazon or Google as being, it's an old company, it's old hat. I mean, we probably think, and then if you pull in Apple and Microsoft, I mean, they're practically ancient, aren't they?
Yeah.
But then when you actually compare them to the lifespan of many other companies all around the world that have been doing things for, you know, decades, generations, 100 years, actually they're very young, aren't they?
Yeah, I think the people think of tech as changing quite rapidly and therefore it's unpredictable. But if you take Microsoft, I mean, a share which we don't own, but if you look at the longevity of the extremely profitable franchises they've had in operating systems and in productivity tools, you know, I think you would struggle to come up with many companies that can compare with that type of profitability over that type of time frame. And I think what's remarkable about these businesses is actually how little challenge they have in the core areas in which they operate. So you see stuff in the press about competition between these companies, but actually it tends to be at the margin or in the next new business. You know, you see very few threats to Alphabet in search through the Google search engine or to Tencent in social media in China. It's more who's going to win the next market or the next iteration. And that extends to a stock like Microsoft, you know, that it dominated in operating systems or productivity tools, but it missed the transition to mobile. So it wasn't that it lost its core franchise, it's just that it didn't grow into the next big opportunity.
I'm sure we'll get to the US and China in a moment, but given that you get a lot of tech entrepreneurs popping up in clutches outside of the obvious two largest economies in the globe, are you noticing any particular geographic regions at the moment which is exciting on the technology front?
I think Silicon Valley is remarkable for the...
Yep.
In particular for the duration of which it's had this cluster of entrepreneurial companies. I think today some of the ideas, the technology and the strength of the businesses that are coming out of Beijing and the east coast of China are on a par, if not better, than their Silicon Valley counterparts. And then I think a lot of places in the rest of the world are just struggling to catch up with that. I think Berlin stands out. You've seen some new, really interesting, great companies come out of Berlin, and pick up some of our holdings. Things like Zalando, the clothing retailer and marketplace, would be an example of that. It seems to have that necessary quality of being a melting pot for ideas of people for different backgrounds, where there is some access to capital, in part provided by one of our listed holdings, Rocket Internet. But I do think the opportunity is there for that footprint to expand. You know, if you go back 10 or 15 years and looked at the online opportunity, you know, it was predominantly in the US. There was a requirement for much larger amounts of capital to exploit that opportunity. Today, there's more than 3 billion smartphone users. That footprint is global. The US is less than 10% of the user base. And you don't need to go to Sand Hill Road in Palo Alto to raise huge amounts of capital to exploit that opportunity, because you can use the services of companies like Amazon or Google to host your infrastructure, or use the Google Play Store or Apple to access that consumer base. It's operating costs, not capital costs.
And you mentioned Amazon earlier.
Yeah.
Obviously, that is the largest holding that the trust has, doesn't it? And many people would look at Amazon, even if they'll admit that, yes, maybe the business isn't that old in real business terms, but they'll think Amazon's share price has absolutely rocketed, you know. And surely it's gone as far as it has to go. What's the point of holding Amazon for the future? Haven't we had the best of that story?
Yeah.
Now, presumably, you see something else going on there. What is that?
I think Amazon is a large company. It's not an undiscovered gem. But I think people just massively underestimate where they can get to with this business model. It is the dominant online e-commerce company, but it still is a tiny proportion of retail sales in the US. You know, if you define the opportunity as retail more broadly, it's still only about half the size of Walmart. But the drivers of that business get more and more powerful each year. So the technology that displays at shopfront improves. So the merchandising gets better. You know, think we used to look at these things on desktop computers, and increasingly it's a mobile device in your pocket with a better screen, with better capability of displaying the product. But on also the back-end infrastructure, it gets better and better. And so the parcels turn up faster, more predictably, more reliably. And you saw a great example of that this year. So Amazon's business had been decelerating through last year. And then in the US, in the first quarter, they introduced one-day free shipping. Now, we're used to that here in the UK, but Prime in the US has always been two-day free shipping. And you've seen the business in the US accelerate now through the last two quarters. We're about 22% today in paid unit growth. And what that illustrates is that Amazon is still in control of its own destiny in terms of developing the product, building out the services to actually drive growth. It's not dependent on the general health of the consumer or what's happening in the economy more broadly to deliver growth. It can engineer products and services to drive growth in the business.
And then there are huge new categories that are really just opening up to online. Grocery would be a great example. It's $500 billion industry in the US. And the online penetration is tiny. And we're more used to online grocery here in the UK. We have one of the highest penetration rates in the world. But for continental country, it's not really yet been possible with technology. So you've got these big new categories. At the same time, you have big new geographies. So India was not a market which was addressable in the era of the PC because you just didn't get the penetration into the population. But with smartphones, you know, you now have that penetration and it can drive significant new businesses. So I think retail has you have a lot more to go for. Things like advertising are only just sort of finding their place on the platform. It can improve the user experience, and it's a tool that merchants have been demanding. So again, that's another driver of the business. But then what's always been brilliant about Amazon is its ability to drive innovation and experimentation at scale. And that's what's delivered products like Amazon Web Services, so the hosting of IT infrastructure. That's a $1 trillion opportunity in and of itself. And Amazon has this leading position in a world where companies are increasingly just outsourcing their infrastructure to third parties. So it's that ability to spot new opportunities and innovate that lead us to believe that the growth rate from here can be just as attractive as it was when the company was a quarter of its current size.
So it's like a retailer that has a whole other business built into it, in a sense.
Yes, but it also has a culture of experimenting and finding new opportunities. You know, look at the Alexa devices, the voice search. Why would Amazon have a business in voice search? Well, you know, it's because they've sought out ways to improve customer experience, looked at the skill set of the company, looked at what will help fulfill their customers' needs, and then that takes you to these voice assistant type products, you know. And you shouldn't look at the voice assistant as what you have in today's products, but think about what happens as it gets exponentially better in 5 or 10 years' time, and that prospect of ambient computing, and not just in the home but in the car or wherever you are, and that's a really valuable tool for Amazon because it doesn't have to monetize it by, you know, what's, you know, Alexa, what's the weather, sponsored by whoever. You know, it's because you use that service to order products, or it just makes you use Amazon services more. So, you know, you can sell voice search products and as a result sell more shoes. And that's a business model advantage that nobody else can match.
So in terms of China then, you said earlier it's very much coming up on the rails. Mm. Presumably you've got some interesting stocks that you either hold or are looking at there?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we own some big established businesses in China. So Alibaba in the retail space, or Tencent in social media. But what we also see in China is a next generation of companies coming through that are able to scale enormous businesses by virtue of their huge domestic market. And when these businesses emerge, they come through a maelstrom of competition. You know, it's a ruthlessly competitive environment. You know, any idea that anybody has is copied and replicated hundreds of times. So if you actually manage to achieve scale, you've been really battle-hardened. And then you have a huge domestic market. So take something like food delivery. We own Meituan Dianping. This is a food delivery business in China and other local services, cinema tickets, etc. Now, there are other examples of these type of businesses around the world. We have Just Eat in the UK. You know, the biggest one in the US has been Grubhub. Now, Grubhub delivers about 500,000 meals a day. Meituan delivers 20 million meals a day. You know, the scale of these businesses is just unthinkably large relative to the Western counterparts. And that home market scale, I think, becomes a real edge, in addition to the technology skills and the drive of the founders and the ruthless competitive environment that they've been brought up in.
I wanted to ask you about another company in the top 10 of the trust holdings that, as I was looking through it, really caught my eye. Mm. Now, there's a car company in there that I would expect to see in there. I know that you guys have held for a long time in Tesla.
Yep.
That's obviously fits into the whole model of, you know, very tech-enabled, forward-thinking company changing the world. But there's a much more old-fashioned car company name in there, which made me think of the wonderful image of Enzo Ferrari barking at an Alexa to do what he wanted it to do, which is Ferrari.
Yep.
Why do you hold Ferrari? What's so attractive about that company?
The attraction of Ferrari to us is that it is a luxury goods company. We think it is possibly the most attractive brand in the world. And going back to when we bought it, we felt like it was being valued like a traditional automotive company. And what you've seen over the past few years is the realization that actually there's a really valuable luxury franchise that ought to be able to both grow price points and desirability, but and also volumes. And so, you know, it what we also would believe about it is that the management absolutely understand the challenges of the world that they're operating in, an industry in transformation. And we think they can both retain the desirability of the brand as you go through that transition and also embrace some of the opportunities that it creates. So think of Hermès, you know, that brand was very much based around using horses as transportation, but the brand has persisted as a luxury franchise despite that core use case diminishing hugely in prospects over time.
So yes, it's not the expectation that Ferrari is suddenly going to up its notoriously limited production, although that has gone up, hasn't it?
Yeah.
It's the all the other things it can do. But does a company like that have to be very careful not to do that too much, to throw the baby out with the bathwater type thing?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, when you look at luxury brands, they are the epitome of the type of company that you don't want driven by stock market expectations. You know, trying to deliver on a quarterly basis, you know, because that encourages all the things you don't want in terms of the development, long-term development of the brand. It's about short-term profitability, you know, reducing investment, reducing advertising to increase profits, to pay out the options of the professional management team on a three-year view. So I think having the influence of families on the shareholder register or some other entity which can enable a really long-term time horizon is really important. You know, if you look at Kering, which we also own, the company that owns Gucci or Bottega Veneta, you know, it's the Pinault family, Monsieur Pinault himself, that ensure that the development of those brands happens over long periods of time. And I absolutely think you have that at Ferrari.
And you also invest in unquoted companies, those that aren't listed on the stock exchange, and they make up a sizable chunk of the portfolio now,
yep.
I think. How does that work, and how difficult is that as a £7.5 billion trust, finding companies that aren't listed on the stock exchange that are big enough that when you buy some of them, you know, you're not taking a huge chunk of the company?
Yep. Well, I think there's been a massive change in the way companies are choosing to finance themselves. You know, using the tools of these online giants we've been talking about, so hosting your infrastructure on Amazon, not having to invest in kit and distribution, that you can access this huge potential addressable audience of users. And when you have that combination, you need much less capital. And if you don't have financiers controlling your boardroom, pushing you to go public so they can realize a return, then companies are choosing to stay private longer. There's so much capital in private markets, they can easily finance themselves. And so what you're seeing is the number of publicly listed companies reduce. You're seeing companies choosing to list at a much later stage in their life cycle. And so if we're to maintain our opportunity set, we believe we have to go looking for private investment opportunities. And this is not looking for very small companies. It's not becoming venture capitalists. It's investing in substantial businesses that in other areas would be publicly listed companies. So we own ByteDance, the owners of the TikTok social network. We invested in that company at a $75 billion valuation. It's not a small business. And so we shouldn't equate private with small. I really don't believe we should equate private with risky, because I think these are the companies that are driving a lot of the changes in traditional industries which will harm their listed counterparts. So we believe we have to just go for the world's best growth companies and be agnostic as to whether they're private or public companies.
Tom, that's all we've got time for. Thank you very much. It's very interesting. Richard, thank you very much.
Thank you
very much for joining us on The Investing Show. See you next time. Goodbye.